So what we saw yesterday is that we got the part that we wanted, which was throughout the manifold, we got the Einstein tensor times the variation of the inverse metric. But we also had this boundary term that, strictly speaking, didn't vanish in the way that boundary terms conventionally vanish for the Lagrangian principle. So normally, if we have, for example, when we did the massless scalar yesterday, we had an expression when we integrated by parts that had a boundary integral of delta phi times stuff. And it's okay to set our variation of the scalar zero on the boundary, but here when we integrate by parts, we don't get delta g, we get derivatives of delta g, and this would mean we would have to set not just delta g, but equal to zero, not just on the boundary, but also in a region near the boundary to make those derivatives vanish. So it's not quite legitimate in terms of our usual Lagrangian principles of mechanics, but at least it's telling us it's the right thing for getting the equations of motion. So from a dynamical perspective, it's fine, but we suspect that from the perspective of a full action, it's not going to be the full story. And indeed, if we thought about it, we have a whole host of interesting physical solutions to the vacuum Einstein equations, and the vacuum Einstein equations would have R equals zero. So our action would then not distinguish between physically distinct solutions. So what we're going to do today is to now try and think about this boundary term. And in some sense, I mean, one way of thinking about it is imagining that we can allow a boundary to fluctuate. And we're going to look for a boundary term to add to our action that will cancel this off. So that's the philosophy of what we're trying to do. And what this means is that we need to think about submanifolds. So if we have our manifold M, and then let's say we just cut it off somewhere, then we're going to just explore, we want to explore some boundary term, but we want to know what it means to have a boundary, and a boundary is something with a lower dimensionality than the manifold. So it's a submanifold. So the idea of a submanifold is that it is a surface or hypersurface, or it's something living in the manifold of lower dimensionality. But if you think of it just in and of itself, it also satisfies all those axioms of being a manifold. So what I'm going to be having this sort of picture, I guess, of sigma as being our manifold is sort of surrounding this. So sigma is a manifold in its own right, but it also can be thought of as being somehow inside M. And so we have our dimension of M is going to be D, and the dimension of sigma is going to be little d. So the first thing that we define is the co-dimension of the manifold. So we've got the submanifold, sorry. The submanifold itself has a particular dimension, which we're labeling little d, and the co-dimension of sigma is the number of additional dimensions sort of that live in the manifold but not in sigma. So we have this little n is d minus d. And what it means is that we often think of a surface as being defined by its normal. And what this means is there are n normals to sigma. So in abstract index notation, I would write those as ni mu, or if I have a set of coordinates on sigma, which I might label as little sigma with a capital A, then the normals acting on those functions give me zero. So that's the same statement. So I can picture my normals as sort of sticking out from the surface like that. So just to make it obvious, A is going to label the index on sigma, mu or A, index on M, and I is going to label normal indices. So it should be obvious, but just to be clear, the little I, J, K or whatever are going to label the normal directions, and the capital indices are going to be the intrinsic directions. So we have sigma A are the coordinates on sigma. So these are our charts on sigma. And of course, our x mu are the coordinates on m. So we could think of our surface as sort of being defined as a set of constraints on our space-time coordinates. And so we would often write that as a sort of set of coordinates, x mu of sigma A. So we'd have a set of functions, so constraints. So this n of sigma A equals zero, we could also think of this as the following relation in terms of our coordinate functions and our indices on non-geometric notation. So dx mu by d sigma A is a tangent vector in the in the manifold. It's kind of saying that if we have our sigma here, this is dx mu by d sigma A, sort of tangent to sigma. And so you can sort of see it as in some ways, as sort of projecting down onto the surface. So just to note, I'm going to take my normals to be normalized to be either plus or minus one. I can always do that. I can always rescale a normal to be plus or minus one. And so there's a lot, that's sort of going to be what I've done. Okay, so that's just saying what the manifold is. And now we want to think about some structure on the man. Yep.
Why can't you have null normals?
Sorry?
Why can't you have null normals?
So, okay, so you could, in principle, I guess, have a null surface. So then you'd have to, but then because of the, you know, the fact you'd have to be much more careful about how you projected the metric out, because it's kind of a degenerate limit of either a time-like or space-like. So I think, yeah, so I think you can deal with null surfaces, but it's a bit more, you have to be a little bit more careful. So what I'm doing here is I'm kind of running through. So obviously when Gauss, so this is called Gauss-Kodazzi just for short, because it was developed by Gauss and Kodazzi. So when they developed this, they were thinking very much of Riemannian manifolds, which were what we would call Euclidean. Yes, you can do it, but you have to be a little more careful. So here, my subtext here is that I'm either thinking of a surface that is time-like, right? Something, you know, that's time-like and fluctuating like a brain. And the other application of this is where your normal is time-like. So you have space-like surfaces and you're doing like a foliation of your space-time. And that would be what you would do if you were looking at numerical relativity, or if you were sort of doing quantum gravity quite often, they have this sort of foliation, this notion of foliating space-time. So I'm just trying to sort of stick here to the sort of, you know, fairly straightforward cases. Okay, so the first thing that we can think of is if our submanifold is sitting inside our manifold, then it can inherit a lot of structure from our underlying space-time manifold. So we can think of this as just being the structure on sigma is being projected down from the structure on our space-time. Now we have a metric on our space-time, and so we can simply project down our metric onto the surface sigma. And in essence, all we're doing in doing that is just taking away all the normal behavior of the metric. And the normal behavior of the metric is contained in the normals. So here we have to add our n, a, n, b if n is space-like. And we subtract n, a, n, b if m is time-like. So that's just the reason for the difference in sign. And so h is just the metric that sigma inherits from m. But notice that the indices on h are still a, b. They're not capitalized. So this H, while it's projecting into sigma, it still lives in the cotangent bundle of M not of sigma. We can also think of sigma in our own right. We could be flatlanders and pretend we don't know about the manifold at all, in which case we would be using our coordinates sigma A. So this is, if you like, a sort of bigger picture. We're looking at it from the perspective of the manifold, but we can also think about sigma intrinsically as if we just live inside sigma. So this derivative, this tangent to sigma, actually takes, it can take something from the cotangent space of M and map it into the cotangent space of sigma. And so our intrinsic metric is simply the projection of the metric into this cotangent space of sigma. I'm just trying to sort of, you know, emphasize that we can stay in our own manifold, the higher dimensional manifold M, or we can actually project down into the manifold sigma. So some of this language, I don't know if you've had a course on string theory yet, but you'll see some of this language cropping up when you do get a course on string theory, because the string world sheet is an example of a submanifold as we think about it, where our manifold is space-time. So that's telling us about the distance function our submanifold inherits from the manifold. So the second fundamental form is the symmetrized derivative of the normal, and this measures how our submanifold curves in the manifold. It's telling us about the embedding of the submanifold in our manifold. So here we should have a picture, something like this. If this is a submanifold, it's a line, a curve on the plane. So this is our example of a submanifold. If I sketch the normals, what you see is that from our perspective, because we can see the full two-dimensional manifold, we see that this normal is actually changing in direction as we move along the curve. So if I take this vector here, for example, and compare it to the vector just a little bit further along my surface, I see that I have a discrepancy. I have a shift in my normal vector, and that shift here is parallel to my surface. So that's kind of what this is saying. The normals shift in direction as we move around the surface if we've decided to make our surface sort of wrinkle in our higher dimensional manifold. This doesn't mean it's sort of real curvature in any sense. It's saying that our embedding is non-trivial. Our embedding is more complicated. So we can also write this in terms of the extrinsic curvature, where we have now capitalized indices, so it's living in the cotangent space of our submanifold. And this now gives us a different way of writing the extrinsic curvature, because remember the normal, the contraction of the normal with one of these projection vectors vanishes. So this is equal to minus n dotted with with the sort of second derivative of x mu with respect to sigma. So we take the second derivative of x with respect to the coordinates and then project that out normal to our submanifold. So notice that if I took the trace of this extrinsic curvature, I would get something that looked like a wave equation for the x mu. So just say notice that. So let's just look at it in the case of an example. It's not particularly, you know, which is also in the handout. It's not particularly hard using Gauss-Kadatze. It's just more the sort of, you know, what tends to be more challenging is just being clear of, you know, which bits are intrinsic, which bits are extrinsic. Is that a question?
How does the coordinates in M carry the index B with respect to sigma there?
How do the...
Because you have dx mu, dx B. Maybe I'm not seeing it.
Thank you. Typo, thanks.
Okay.
Thank you very much for that. Thanks. Yeah, because below, when I write the wave operator, I put a little sigma to indicate the derivatives. This is a wave operator that's living entirely within the submanifold. So this actually is where you get a slightly sort of different way of thinking about this as an embedding, because there, that would be saying that the x mu, our manifold, our bigger space-time, those coordinates could be thought of then as fields living on the submanifold, and those fields would obey a wave equation. So that's, again, you know. So it's sort of taking, we've started off from a big picture down to a little picture, but with, you know, with strings, you have the little picture and you build up the big picture. So. So here's an explicit example of a surface living in R cubed. It's a cylinder. So my normal is obviously a radial vector. And so it points outwards. So if I write it in Cartesians, my normal is just cos theta sine theta zero, good old fashioned vectors. So here, my h is delta AB minus NANB, because I'm in Euclidean R cubed. So the length of my normal is one. And so H if I follow the rules of what I wrote down, this is my HAB in Cartesian coordinates. But I could also use polars. So if I was in polars, all I would do is I would get rid of the the GRR piece, which is one. So that's my HAB in polars. And then, of course, gamma AB where my coordinates are theta and z. So that's my intrinsic metric. Here, because what I have to do is I need to project out the, so here, remember our signature was plus, minus, minus, minus. So what you have to do is to get rid of the normal part of the metric. So if n squared is plus one, you subtract it. If n squared is minus one, you add it. So it might help to think about, you know, if you're in Cartesian, Minkowski space-time. This is your full four-dimensional metric. So if you wanted to, say, project onto just the xy, txy plane, you'd want to get rid of that term. And so you would have to add nz, nz. Yep. So it's just, again, it's just the sign is... Here we're in a completely Euclidean space, so we are subtracting nn. But when you're in space-time, you have to just pause and think, do I subtract, do I add? So in polar coordinates, k is just the covariant derivative of the normal n. And so that's just minus gamma RAB. Which only has one component. So let's just see if this all makes sense. The cylinder is completely straight in the Z direction. So it's vertically very straight. So there's no Z dependence in our embedding. So there's sort of nothing going on in the Z direction. So that means that we wouldn't really expect to see if any, I can also write this as KAB is A000. I wouldn't expect to see anything happening with the extrinsic curvature in the Z direction because nothing's happening with the embedding in the Z direction. On the other hand, in the XY plane or in the theta direction, as I go round in theta, my normal is changing. So my normal is sort of sweeping round. The radial direction changes at a sort of uniform rate as I go around my cylinder. And so here, this is constant, so that's saying it's a uniform rate. And if I think about it, kind of think about this in terms of as normalized. If I were to sort of take a unit, theta vector, that would just be KAB equaled 1 0 0 0. So it's kind of something that's very uniform, independent. Although that radius is there, that the A, it's only there because we've got an A squared in our metric. So this is a sort of very uniform behavior for the extrinsic curvature. And it's reflecting the fact that our embedding is just a nice uniform circle. We're just sweeping round in a very regular way. So there are a couple of other things to define. What we're really doing here is we're taking the things that we derived last week for the space-time manifold, curvature, connection, etc., and we're really just splitting them up into things that are parallel or perpendicular to our surface. So K is kind of like the connection parallel to the surface. But we've also got a connection normal to the surface, and this is encoded in the normal fundamental forms. Which tell us about how the normals twist. So if we've only got one normal, it's basically we don't have any choice. Our normal is normal to the surface, and that's the end of the story. If we have codimension two or more, then our normals, if I had a curve in three-dimensional space, a curve has two normals. So I can think of that as just putting two vectors normal to my curve. So as I move along the curve, I mean, obviously, if we're doing this, we would try and be if I had the curve simply the z-axis, we would probably just take, well, x and y normals, and we would just do the obvious thing and transport them straight up. But I could equally well just be awkward and say, nope, as I move up, I want to move my normals, oscillate them back and forth. They would still be normal to the surface. It wouldn't change anything intrinsic. But now my normals are varying as I move around my surface. But they're not varying parallel to the surface. They're sort of varying amongst each other. So this is kind of saying, how much do the normals just twist around as we go on the surface? So typically, this is, again, it's a choice most of the time. It's a gauge quantity, unless there is some intrinsic torsion in the surface. So this is our connection on the normal bundle of sigma. So picture it as a sort of twisting of the normals as you go around the or along the surface. So that's talking about the connection or the first derivatives of G, the metric. So we want to now relate the curvature of our submanifold sigma to the curvature of M. And this is related via the Gauss equation. And so what we do is we take the higher dimensional Riemann curvature, project down every index. So I'm writing down here the Gauss equation for one normal, which is space-like. If you have a time-like normal, this sign would change. If you have more normals, you just sum up this expression for every normal that you've got. So that is saying that to get the curvature of the submanifold, you take the Riemann of the higher dimensional manifold, project it out like crazy, and then you add in these extrinsic curvature terms. So it's really sort of saying that the curvature is a combination of intrinsic and non-trivial extrinsic parts. So you could also see these KK terms as being like gamma wedge gamma. Remember, the curvature is D gamma plus gamma wedge gamma structurally. And so these are like from gamma wedge gamma. So I'm going to demonstrate this in this particular case, one normal that's space-like. And it's what we do is we use the Riemann identity. And so we take a vector lying completely tangent to the manifold. So it has zero normal derivative. And then we're going to manipulate the Riemann identity from the lower dimensional manifold perspective and to kind of unravel it into a higher dimensional Riemann with these extra extrinsic curvature terms. So just as a preamble, one of the things that we'll need to know is if we have, I'm going to assume that my normal is unit, so n squared is minus 1, and I'm going to take grad n of n equal to 0. So I can always do this. I have a normal, and I extend it geodesically off the submanifold. So all we're in, if we're just interested in sigma, we don't, you know, we're not constraining what we do off sigma, so I can take my normal and just integrate it out geodesically. So I have those two relations. And then what this means is that my extrinsic curvature is just the derivative of the normal. I don't need to project out with any first fundamental forms, because if I dot with this left-hand side with the normal, I get zero. So I'm just giving some preamble so that when doing the calculation, we've got all the little pieces of information that we need. Okay, so let's just derive that relation. Oh, one last piece didn't write down, sorry. Our covariant derivative is defined by taking our higher dimensional manifold derivative and projecting out with respect to the first fundamental form.
Sorry, could you explain again why there's, in the first term on the most right-hand side, why there's no like HAV?
Sorry, with the...
The first term on the... right-hand side of that board.
This one?
Yeah.
So the reason is that when you, if you've got KAB, you know, would be HAC, HBD, grad C, and D normally. And so I replace each of these with delta AC plus NANC, delta BD plus NB and D, grad C and D, yep. And then, so let's just look at that second bit, right? So when this N hits that expression, this is ND gradient of ND, so that's a half the gradient of, so ND gradient ND is a half gradient of nd squared, and nd squared is 1, that's 0. And then, so this term doesn't contribute. And then when this term hits the derivative, I said I was extending geodesically off the submanifold. So when this nc hits that grad c, that gives me a grad n. So that vanishes as well. Yep. It's really saying that the reason for that, for those H's being there, is to make sure that you don't get any spurious contribution, you know, when you're taking the covariant derivative of N. If you'd had a general normal with general length that was varying and extended any which way off the submanifold, you would get terms in grad A and B that were completely spurious and nothing at all to do with the submanifold. So they would be completely sort of normal nonsense. So that's why the general expression projects it out. But I have chosen my gauge. Basically, what I'm doing here is partially fixing a gauge. I'm saying that this direction is governed, if you like, I'm taking a coordinate, which is the proper distance from my surface. And so d, if that coordinate is xi, d by d xi is my normal. And, you know, my in my metric, I would have d xi squared. So I can always do this locally. It doesn't mean I can do it globally, but I can always do it locally. Where am I? CD. So I use the Riemann identity. So I'm saying this Riemann identity, this expression, is grad DC. Grad DD VA minus C interchanged with D. And then I'm substituting in what this covariant, sigma covariant derivative is. And then I substitute in what it is here. And now you see why I took the time to pause to write down all those things, because here I have first of all, I get a second derivative of V. And then I've got the derivatives of the H. So the first term, this line, it's anti-symmetric in C and D, which makes it anti-symmetric in F and P. So that means I can use the Riemann identity in my higher dimensional space-time. To get the higher dimensional Riemann tensor times V. Then I look at the bottom line and I see that if I take the covariant derivative of H, what I get here, so in this case, this is going to give me KFPNG plus a KFGNP. And when I take the derivative of that term, I'm going to get KFENQ plus KFQNE. So now when I look at that, let me see. Here I've got a normal NG, which is going to hit to first fundamental form. So that vanishes, that gets killed. Here I've got a normal, which is hitting the derivative of V, and V is something that's completely lying in sigma, so that term gets killed. Here I've got an NE, which hits this first fundamental form there, so that term gets killed. And so I'm only left with a single term from all that mess, And so that's what I get. But now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to basically, because V is normal to N, I can swap that differentiation. So I've got HAE, HFC. I just look at this term. HGD, HPG, and then KEF. And then it's minus VQ grad P NQ. So I've used the fact that V and N are normal to swap the derivative acting on V to a derivative acting on N. So again, I'm just going to keep looking at this term here. Here I've got this. This gives me an HPD. So I have a KDQ, VQ. I've got KEF, which turns into KAC here. And so that's actually what that all boils down to. All that mess. So what that means is, putting a big equals in front of it all and relabeling some indices. Except I need to do the R. There we go. So that's the first term, having relabeled my indices to agree with what I wrote for the Gauss expression. And then here, don't have to work too hard on this one, it's minus KAC, KBD, minus C interchanged with D. We go. So in other words, by using the Riemann identity, I've verified this Gauss equation. I've proved this Gauss equation for any V. It didn't. The only thing that I needed of V was that it was tangent to sigma, but that's okay because this Riemann tensor here is indeed the Riemann tensor of sigma. So I've proved the result. So notice with that example of the cylinder, that cylinder, oh, another question, yeah.
Can you explain what actually the left of R index means, the D brackets? I'm sure I understand.
Sorry, which?
It's left of R, the Riemann tensor. Why do we have that fifth?
The D in the brackets?
In the
notation?
Yeah.
Which one?
The super index to the left.
Super index to the left of the Riemann tensor.
Oh, that is just the index. That's sort of saying it's the lower dimensional index. So little d was the dimensionality of sigma. Mm-hmm. So that's saying it's the d dimensional, the little d dimensional Riemann. Mm-hmm. And the other one is the big d dimensional Riemann. So d, big D was the dimension. It's now been erased. But big D is the dimension of the higher. So I'm only doing it for codimension one, but this is true for you know, for more general co-dimension. And so it's saying that your curvature of your surface is this combination of the higher dimensional curvature projected down and the extrinsic curvature. And sort of if you look at it for the cylinder, the higher dimensional curvature is zero because it's flat R cubed. And although the extrinsic curvature isn't zero, when you take this combination, this anti-symmetric combination, it's only got one component. So as soon as you anti-symmetrize it, it dies. And so even the K terms are zero for the cylinder. So what this is saying, this is sort of a very good example of emphasizing the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic curvature. The cylinder is actually Ricci or Riemann flat, but it's not got zero extrinsic curvature. So it has extrinsic but not intrinsic curvature. So I think that's one of the confusing things when you first hear that the cylinder is flat. You sort of think, but it doesn't look flat. And it isn't flat, but its curvature is extrinsic and not intrinsic. So just to come back to that starting point there, if I look at a, now thinking about a boundary term, so I'm going to look for a boundary term that might actually work to cancel off this. Then the trace of the extrinsic curvature kind of looks like a promising scalar to think about. So let's look at how that acts under a variation. So once again, I'm going to take n squared is minus one, I guess, grad n, n equals zero. And HAB is, of course, GAB plus NANB. So I'm thinking here of a boundary, say, at large R.
Can I ask one more question?
Mm-hmm.
The R with the little d, that gives you the intrinsic curvature.
The intrinsic, that is the real curvature. That's the honest-to-God Riemann curvature of sigma, yeah? Okay.
Even though the indices are small and not like...
Yeah, because this... So, yeah. Okay. Yes, you're correct. This is lying in the tangent space of M, but you could, by acting with the, you know, the derivatives of the coordinate functions, you could turn those, in these at least, into capital indices, and this implicitly into a capital index via the inverse of gamma. And so it, yes, you're right. It's lazy to call it an intrinsic because I haven't yet projected it fully into the tangent space of sigma. But that's because I'm obviously relating it to a higher dimensional Riemann. But once I'm here, if you were to take the gamma AB and compute the Riemann tensor of gamma AB via the normal procedure, you'd get this thing. Okay, so I'm now thinking of my variational principle. So in the process, I'm going to keep my normal to be unit. I'm going to keep my normal to be geodesic. And so I'm going to see what that gives me. So keeping my normal to be unit tells me delta NA. So if what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to think about how I relate my delta GAB and split it up into a delta H and a delta N. Because my normal remains normal, that tells me that, it doesn't tell me that delta NA dotted with H vanishes, but it does relate delta NA dotted with H to NA dotted with delta H. So, so now I take the variation of the expression for the first fundamental form and I dot it with the normal. And so here, I've used that relation of delta H dot N. And then here, my HAB is just GAB plus NANB. So the NANB cancels with that. And what I end up with is an expression for the variation of the normal in terms of the variation of the metric. So this is telling us that, you know, if you notice in that expression here that we were trying to kind of cancel, this is all about normal derivatives of the metric. And so what I want to do is to extract what's happening to the variation of the metric in the normal direction. So if I ask, what is the variation of that trace of the extrinsic curvature? Well, the trace of the extrinsic curvature is just the divergence of N. And so I take delta of n, the divergence of delta n, and delta of the connection. And so this second term is just the normal derivative of delta g, and the first term is just the divergence of n dot delta g. So this first term is going to give me an extrinsic curvature. And so now I see that I actually have grad n delta g, which is over there, and n dotted with the divergence of delta g, which is the second term over there. So this is exactly going to cancel with that boundary term there. So what this says So I apologise for this getting very cramped and being down in the corner there. I just didn't want to spend time rubbing the board. But so this extra term here, is called the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. So if I add this boundary term on to my gravitational action, I cancel off the illegal part of my variation. And although it's what I get is here is a KAB delta GAB. Now, from the variational, if we're just interested in equations motion in the bulk, we wouldn't see that term. But I just put it in there for completeness. We also get a term which is KAB minus KHAB times the variation of the metric on the boundary. So normally we just say delta H was zero. So that's now, with some effort, made our variational Lagrangian approach to gravity consistent. But it's also introduced us a boundary term, which is going to prove to be quite convenient because now we have a way potentially of distinguishing vacuum Einstein solutions. Even though R is zero, this boundary integral won't necessarily vanish, as we will see. Okay.